All right, this is the special post-election edition, November 9th class of environmental law. And we are wrapping up the substantive discussion of CERCLA today and then preserving hopefully around 45 minutes at the end of class to do our mock negotiation session. We have covered the basics, the ingredients of liability under CERCLA, the categories of PRPs, the rat's nest of exclusions that can apply to liability. We've talked about the process, how Superfund site begins, grows, gets cleaned up, and gets taken off the national priorities list. And we've talked a little bit about some of the issues of how you allocate, create liability, when it can be joined several, and how you can apportion it, and what sort of factors play into that. So, as always, any questions about any of those concepts before I try and wrap up today talking about settlement processes? Okay. Then let me just begin by saying that I'm going to do something I really hate doing, which is I'm going to distill this down into some very black and white statements for you. But if you have questions about it or you want to throw some mud in the water, please halt me at any point. The key thing is this. We've talked about the liability engine of CERCLA, the way that it gets embodied in judgments and administrative orders, but all of this ends up with an end game. And this is where the lawyers play a key role, namely how you divide up and allocate and settle these claims in such ways that the money gets shipped to the right parties. So for our perspective, there are two things you need to have in mind. Number one, Superfund gives you two ways to get your money back. If you are a private party and you feel like you have paid more than you should have, you have either the option of a private cost recovery action under Section 7107A of CERCLA. Private cost recovery simply means that you are acting as if you were a government party who had done the cleanup. It effectively means that you have the advantage of taking the same tools that EPA would use to chase you, but you can use them to chase other parties. Versus 113F, which is CERCLA's statutory contribution provision. Notice this is not common law. This is actually governed by the language of the statute, which means that it has a more reliable basis in one way, but it also means you're constrained by the actual statutory choices that Congress made the language of put into the statute. What are the key differences here? Well, one, if I have a 107 action, it's a pretty cool place to be. First of all, I can get joint several liability if I can prove indivisible harm. I cannot get it under contribution. That right there oftentimes is the game determiner. If I can get a 107 action and then have the tool of joint several liability wield against other parties, I will go there if I can do it in any possible way. Second, my statute of limitations under a private cost recovery action are much more generous. Essentially, I can postpone my recovery action until 6 years after the initiation of my remedial action. There's a separate time limit for removal actions, but usually what happens is the removal gets rolled into the remediation, so effectively this is what really drives it.
6 years after what?
The initiation of remediation. As opposed to contribution, 3 years from when you incur the cost. Again, oftentimes that's a game determiner. If you have a pile of bills and you've already missed your window, you're going to do everything you humanly can to bring a 107A claim, private cost recovery. Four, your burden of proof. For a private cost recovery action, to recover your cost, remember our magic sentence? All you have to show is that you incurred costs that were consistent with the National Contingency Plan. The other elements are common. A release of a hazardous substance from a facility. We all know those by heart. You have to show that they're part of that PRP four categories. But essentially, all you have to do is show effectively that you comply with the NCP. Side note, the government doesn't have to prove that. They're presumed to have complied with it. They only showed that they're not inconsistent with it. Contribution, your burden of proof is different. Because a nature contribution is you have to prove that you've paid at a site that someone else shares liability with you and that you paid more than your fair share. Notice you're talking about a totally different set of facts. What was your fair share? What determines that fair share? How is that share fair in light of other parties who aren't at the table? It can be much more complicated and difficult and requires the presence of a larger universe of parties, as opposed to here, where I can effectively do a very common tactic. I pick my victim. Sorry, that sounds terrible, but it's true. This system is designed to allow the private cost recovery claimant to effectively say, all I need is one person who has contributed to an indivisible harm. And that one person has the great fortune of having a checkbook with 10 zeros somewhere in the balance. I'm done. I don't have to implead the other parties. I don't have to bring a collective action. I don't have indispensable parties that I have to bring in. I can effectively bring in that my one poor schmo and have them pick up not only their share, but the other shares that can be allocated to them in the joint several liability. Contribution, all I can get is the fair share. So if I sue that same unfortunate schmo who has a $10 billion check account, but they're only responsible for 1% of the site, and that their total cost is $100,000, guess what? All I can get is $100,000 from it, even if the site costs $20 billion. I effectively, the only way I can get my money is to bring in as many parties as I can and tag them for their fair shares. It's a much more complex and big endeavor. Does that make sense for everyone? So the critical question becomes this. When can I bring a 107A, private cost recovery action? When can I bring a 113F contribution action? And when can I bring both? This was literally the first question I got asked walking into my first environmental law job at Baker Botts. They were still sorting this out back in 1988. They were still hoping that CERCLA, when it was amended by the Superfund Amendments Reauthorization Act of 1986, would answer it. It was a mess. The courts went all over the place. A whole bunch of courts effectively said, if I'm a PRP and therefore share liability at this site, I cannot bring a private cost recovery action. All I can bring is contribution because I share a liability. Other courts said, no, that's all wrong. We want to encourage cleanups. So as long as you are actually incurring money at the site, you can bring both. You get to choose. Others said, effectively, all you can do is a private cost recovery action until you've reached a point where you're actually allocating cost among all the parties at the end of the process. It, frankly, depending on what circuit you're in. All of that was resolved by the Atlantic Research decision. Again, one of the rare mythical unicorns of the law, a Justice Thomas opinion that actually has had some sweeping effect, at least in environmental law. That decision basically said, you guys are asking the wrong questions. It all comes down to this. The same party can bring both actions. That's totally cool with the act language. They're complementary. They cover different kinds of liability. Private cost recovery applies when you incur the cost to clean up the site directly yourself. You clean up the site. That makes you effectively a private cost claimant the same way the government can be. By contrast, I only have contribution if I have to pay a legal judgment. That's what the statutory language says. That's what the common law concept of contribution is. It requires a legal, i.e. monetary, obligation. So here, I'm shoveling dirt. Here, I'm writing a check. And the two can occur with the same party. But which dollars you put into which column matters. I cannot get private cost recovery for a settlement payment. I can't get contribution, or theoretically, maybe, but I really don't want to. I'd rather have private cost recovery if I actually spend the money cleaning up the site. Does that hang together for everybody? I'm boiling it down, but I think that's the takeaway. Connie?
How can you have them both together?
Well, simple. That's a terrible way to answer that. I'm sorry. That's a very good question, and I've had a simplistic answer that I use in what I practice. Which is another way to terrible answer that question, but it comes down to this. Picture I'm a party and I start doing the cleanup. let me put it this way. I can have a cleanup that's over a period of years. The first part, EPA does, they knock on my door and say, pay $3 million that we've incurred at this site. And by the way, we want you to do the rest of the cleanup. And then you actually do the RFS work yourself here. Remember, remedial investigation feasibility study. This is contribution. This can be private cost recovery. I can do both. But I only get this portion of the cost contribution, and only this part can be private cost recovery. Does that make sense?
Yes. And with the statute of limitations, you would potentially have to bring them up as separate.
Exactly. It's an interesting question. You may end up suing for contribution shares here, and you have to make an election whether or not to fold this into that same lawsuit or hold off on it. And I've seen it go both ways. I mean, the risk here is that if these are deemed to be part of an indivisible corpus of the action, that you may potentially waive claims. But most courts are willing to let you do a subsequent lawsuit. What also happens, though, is you counter-lawsuits, counterclaims, and that can precipitate it as well. So that's a very simple question to simple answer to a wonderful question. Any others?
Could you explain the burden of proof from Section 103?
Sure. I have to prove two things. One, that I spent the money, that I wrote the check. That's easy. The second is I have to prove what the other party's fair share is that they didn't pay, that I paid for them. That's the hard part. I have to basically have information on what they sent to the site, how they sent it, what their conduct was, all those equitable gore factors we talked about on Monday, which seems so long ago. Almost a different world. Does that help?
Yeah, I guess.
Any others? All right, then the last piece, and I'm eating into your settlement time, so I'll be quick about this. Now that we have this basic mechanism in place, two big questions. How do you use it, manipulate it, and what happens when you settle a claim? If you have this menu in front of you, and EPA has presented you with a demand to do something about this site, and you can choose to do the cleanup yourself, or you can choose to write a check. Which would you prefer?
You probably prefer to do it yourself because it'll be cheaper in the end.
If you have the money, or if you have a coalition of the willing, absolutely. You can also pick and choose and tell EPA, I'll do this part of the cleanup, and I'll just write a check for the rest, and then you can pursue them if you need to, or we'll do contribution for that. But you can basically segment your cleanup and pick and choose which remedy you want to take advantage of. And notice that that starts affecting the way the cleanup is done. You may want an emergency order for part of your site. You may want a consent decree for a different part of your site. You may want to basically tell EPA, I'm not doing it. This third portion of the site, you go after someone else. We'll just do essentially an apportionment, a carve out of that portion of the site where you have to go after someone else. So I just suggest to you that that element of flexibility and creativity is a vital part of Superfund practice. The second is settlements, which is, imagine, if you will, the following scenarios. We have one big settlement, or one big expenditure at a site, three parties equally share the liability. We'll just, you know, we don't want to worry about how they get that division worked out. Well, it turns out B is gone. So, you know, this site, let's say over here, is going to be 33. Well, this piece of the pie is suddenly vacant. If it's just a straight up bankruptcy and there's been no cash flows, no transfers, the general majority consensus answer is the remaining parties divide up that piece according to their shares of liability. So we both share these equally. We divide this up 50-50. What does that mean? Effectively, we take each half of that, add it to our shares over here, so we end up with 50% each. Notice if the numbers have been different, and instead, it was, let's say here, 20 and 46. Well, I take my 46 plus 17 and lo and behold, I'm suddenly dealing with 63%, which I know is illegible, but bottom line here is that it's not you just divide it evenly. You divide it according to what your relative percentages to each other is. Does that make sense? This is sort of the baseline case, the dead, flood, and bankrupt ones I'm always talking about, the orphan shares. Let's assume something slightly different now. Our same liability here, and let's try and make the numbers a little easier. We have big party responsible for 50%, and then little parties each with 25%. Big party likes a little party, so they decide to give them a sweetheart deal. Instead of paying for their full 25%, they only have to pay half. What happens to that wedge there? How do you split it up? Now, normally, I would take sadistically and torture you for 40 minutes, all the different permutations you could go through here. We talked through the Vertec case that you had in your textbook. We talk about Gore factors and the difference between apportionment and allocation. But what it really comes down to is this. If I'm the United States, CERCLA answers it for you. The statute says that if the United States is B and they settle cheaply here with A, B picks up the slack. Effectively, A gets contribution protection, and the amount that they pay is what's offset for everyone else's liability. Why? Think about it. That's a huge cattle prod in the rear for all the parties who might otherwise play games and delay on resolving their settlement. The longer you wait, the more the United States can use this settlement built-in advantage to shift liability to all the bad faith recalcitrant parties. The statute's designed to be unfair, but in a way to encourage people to clean up sites. Number two, what if it's not the United States, and if this is just money? Just take the actual check that's written here. What if it's not the United States here, but it's a private party? Suppose it's GE. Suppose it's Shell. And they do the sweetheart deal. Here you get a division. Some courts have said, well, what we need to do is figure out what the share would have been, what they should have paid, and then we give credit to the other parties for what portion should have been, even if big company got less than they should have. Effectively, big company bears the risk of sweetheart deals for selling too cheaply. If they end up suing the other party here, sorry, it should be C, and C says, wait a minute, you settled for half what you should have with A, well, all C has to pay is their share. B has to eat the shortfall on their sweetheart deal. Does that make sense? And that's what's called the pro tanto iucata, uniform comparative allocation among tortfeasors, uniform contribution among tortfeasors act, pro tanto approach. Basically, again, it's, uniform comparative fault act. You look at the percentage, their fair share, not what they actually pay. The other is to say it's like the government. The person making the settlement bears the risk of making a sweetheart deal. Then you have the Uniform Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, also known as pro tanto. Again, that's just a fancy way of saying you look at the dollars. You look at what was written on the check. Right now, the majority position is this guy. It's easier, it's simpler, it serves other policy purposes of the act to say, if I'm going to settle with one of my defendants, I have to bear the responsibility of making sure I settle for the full amount of their share. And if I give them an easy out, that's my risk. I can't shift it onto other parties.
Okay, for scenario two, why is B taking A's on A share? Is it because B's settling with A, or... Or I don't know if you said that, but I don't.
I think what happens, I tried to use the same diagram too many times. if it's on a percentage share of joint fault.
Comparative fault act.
The idea here is that effectively, the key, let's use big A here. I'm sorry if the numbers are not matching up exactly the same. A is only able to recover up to 25%, and if they do less, then that's their shortfall. They can't shift it on to C. Actually, no, I'm sorry, I misspoke. You're exactly right. Sorry about that, Carl. If this one is just the actual amount paid, then I do a short settlement, and there's this gap that's not been covered by that cash payment. Under this uniform comparative allocation among joint tortfeasors, this share does not get shifted here. Under this one, in the uniform comparative fault act, essentially, you have to have a trial to measure what their share should have been. If it's 25%, effectively those shares get taken off the table. I think I'm mangling this. I'm sorry about this. This one essentially says you look at the share they should have paid, and that's what you take away from what other parties have to pay. This one, you just look at what they actually paid, and that's what other parties have to pay. So, what does that mean? It means under the Comparative Fault Act, if this guy is responsible for 25% and only pays 10%, C doesn't have to make up the difference. Under this one, if they're responsible for 25% and they only pay 10%, C does have to pick up the difference. Have I mixed those up?
Wait, so it does shift.
One does shift, one does not shift.
Okay, so that's how it's distinct from the United States. Because in situation number one, the U.S. just absorbs that cost. That's what you were saying, though.
Actually, United States, what it says is that under CERCLA, if the United States settles cheaply and as well doesn't get the full contribution from this party, the other parties make up the difference. That's what the statute says. That's why the court's not to mess with it. The statute language is clear. There's no statutory language for private settlements, so that's why they're having to wrestle with what the common law allocation would be.
So if A settles with B under the UCFA, and settles and leaves 15% on the table.
Mm-hmm.
That 15% is then allocated between A and C, or A and C get a credit, or just C gets a credit?
I think C just gets the credit.
So C only has to, so again.
Basically A has to increase the share that they're
paying.
Because
they lowballed.
Right.
And so penalty for lowballing is you're still left holding the bag.
Right.
And so what's the limit? Have they set a limit for lowballing? Like, is it less than 50% or?
There's no limit.
It's
you could let someone walk, and actually that does happen. You could have, for example, an owner of a site who's basically not a corporation, has limited resources. A lot of times PRPs who are big players will say, go. You don't have to pay a thing, just gives us access to your site. That owner's liability gets allocated to the other parties. To the selling parties.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I see furrowed brows.
So, I mean, this is still a three-player negotiations game, right? So is this where A has to make up the shortfall because it settled? I mean, what about the input of C? Is A and C, I mean, is A, like, given the primary role as the, you mentioned it yesterday, of all the PRPs, like a committee or something, is that why they get penalized if they do a sweetheart deal?
I mean, basically, A is the keeper of its own claim. So if they settle too cheaply, A is choosing to incur that cost. So here, if they leave 10% on the table, C's share is still just 25%. But if they leave 10% on the table here, that percentage gets added to C's. That make sense?
Can you drill the government one more time? I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. Because I thought you said the U.S. picks up the slack.
No, it's the other way around.
Okay.
If so, I misspoke.
Yeah.
What statute specifically says is that if the United States settles with a party, one, the government can give contribution protection to that settling party, and two, the credit other parties get is just what that party pays, not what their share percentage-wise of fault would be. So if the government lets a party walk for $1, even though that party theoretically should have paid $1 million, that's fine. The other jointly severally liable PRPs have to pick up that other $999,000. That's the club the government uses to force settlements. Okay? Sorry, I don't know why I just erased that. I was going to draw another one. More questions? I'm beginning to think we may end. Oh, man. How about this? I would not want to deprive you guys of Endangered Species Act discussions next week. That's a very important part of our class. What I would like to do is go ahead, unless you have burning, pressing questions now, let's start the negotiation exercise and try and get it done by 35 minutes. And then we will do the actual presentation of the offer that you guys come to at the beginning of next class and do a postmortem on it. So it will bleed over a little bit to next Monday, but I'll give us a chance at least for you guys to get started with it today. The other thing to keep in mind is, remember, I will not be here on Wednesday. I'll be in D.C. So as much as we can cover on Monday, I would like to do that so that our guest lecturer will not be having to carry extra water. Okay? So anything else before I jump into the exercise? Did everyone get the emails? So everyone here has gotten who they're responsible for? Okay. Perfect time. We're just about to start the exercise. Let me add a few very quick things that are in the textbook, but I'm concerned that we didn't talk about in class. I want to make sure you have them in hand before we start the exercise. There's some terms in the exercise I want to make sure we're crystal clear about. First, special notice letters. That essentially is a letter from EPA saying, you are liable. I talked with you about general notice letters. That's what EPA usually sends. A special notice letter is worse if you're a PRP. It essentially says that the agency has determined that you are responsible, that the agency plans to take action, but that there's a 120-day window that you can negotiate with the agency to try and resolve your liability before EPA acts. So essentially, the timer gets put on place with a special notice letter. Second, 104Es. I mentioned that in the package as well. Hopefully, we talked about it in class. I just honestly I couldn't recall, and it's mentioned in the book, but here's what a 104E is. It's essentially an information request. The statute gives EPA the power to request data from anyone who may be related to the site about what they sent, what waste they generated, what their financial capacity is to pay for the cleanup. The 104E is often sent with the general notice letter saying, welcome to the party. Tell us everything you sent to that site. Give us copies of all your manifest. So the 104E provides the database. It's the discovery of the Superfund process. Third, bankruptcy. Bottom line is that it's a muddled area. Usually, if someone has owned a site in the past but no longer owns it, and there's a liability with it, it's just like any other debt. You can discharge it. You can go to the bankruptcy court, and the government has to negotiate with you and pay pennies on the dollar. If you still own the site, your ability to walk away to bankruptcy is not clear. So that's why your package is basically said the bankruptcy issues are unsettled for your jurisdiction. But I wanted to let you know that we have an entire class on just bankruptcy and environmental liability. And last, mixed funding. All that simply means is that EPA pays part of the cleanup. That they use part of the Superfund to grease the wheels by picking up a small portion of the site so that the other PRPs can help bridge a gap that they can't otherwise negotiate away. Let me warn you, mixed funding is a rare beast. EPA is loath to part with the money. For understandable reasons, they don't have a lot of it, and every dollar they put into a site that PRPs could pay is a dollar less they can spend to deal with an emergency someplace else. Okay? So those were the key things. Any questions before we dive into this? All right, then. The recorder goes off.